The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Means of Ascent, by Robert A. Caro. Continued. Cassette 8, Side 2. Then Johnson sharpened the charge. The secret deal to which Stevenson had agreed in return for AFL support, he said, was that if Stevenson was elected to the Senate, he would vote to repeal the Taft-Hartley Act, the act that was almost sacred in Texas as the symbol of the state's flaming anti-union sentiment. In speech after speech, over the radio and in the small towns to which the helicopter was carrying him, he demanded that Stevenson tell the truth about this secret deal he had made with labor dictators. Stevenson, Johnson said, had sold his soul for the labor vote. He's a yearling with the labor boss brand on his hip. Johnson's charge was untrue. Coke Stevenson was not opposed to the Taft-Hartley Act. He was in favor of it. From the time it had first been proposed in Washington, he had explained to supporters, in his slow, painstaking way, that although he was in general opposed to legislation increasing government regulation of any institution, he was in favor of such regulation when an institution became a monopoly and thereby gained power so great that only government could check its abuses in the interests of the public. Organized labor, he told intimates, had become a monopoly and was abusing its power. And Johnson knew his charge was untrue. Says Paul Bolton, who, under Alvin Wirtz's guidance, was writing most of Johnson's speeches on the labor issue, "We knew it wasn't true, and I almost felt ashamed of what I was writing sometimes. Coke was so honest, you know." Moreover, there had been no secret deal, or at least not one involving Coke Stevenson. The gulf between Johnson's charges and the truth was deepened by the fact that Lyndon Johnson was receiving secret support from labor leaders. The support came in the same form it had taken during Johnson's first campaign for the Senate 7 years before, because he had maintained his ties to the labor movement in the Northeast. As in 1941, substantial amounts of labor cash were raised there and either sent to Texas by Tommy Corcoran and Jim Rowe, or brought in person by Willie Hopkins. On his return trips, Hopkins carried recordings of Coke Stevenson's speeches that had been carefully edited by Johnson's aides to make Stevenson sound more conservative than he was, and that therefore helped Corcoran and Rowe raise still more money from labor and other liberals in Washington and New York to defeat this Neanderthal. Johnson had, with more justification, used the same tactic in his race against O'Daniel in 1941. Once Hopkins, chief counsel for John L. Lewis's United Mine Workers Union, arrived in Texas to hear Johnson excoriating John L. Lewis. "He was saying things that kind of hurt my ears, and that I hated to hear," Hopkins was to recall. "I knew the political reasons for it, but it made me feel a little badly." But he had been sent to Texas to help Johnson, and he did so, contacting UMW supporters and bringing papers, which he will describe only as various documents that Corcoran and Jim Rowe had helped me get, a copy of some sort of document, a government document or some correspondence, not for public use, but that were informative to Lyndon. But these labor connections were kept secret. Hopkins was to recall that he went to Texas just informally and as quiet as I could and purposely stayed away from Lyndon's headquarters. So Johnson was free in a violently anti-labor state to make the most of labor's endorsement of his opponent. Stevenson made one attempt to answer the charge, although he did so, as he had always answered questions in the past, not making a short reply, but explaining the political philosophy that had led him to his decision. In an interview with the Abilene Reporter News on July 3rd, he said, "My policy is to let everyone alone unless he needs regulating. But when any segment of society becomes a monopoly, it needs to be regulated. I think the Taft-Hartley Act is all right as far as it is needed to keep down a monopoly." When Boyette and other advisers suggested that the last sentence might need clarification, Stevenson refused to issue any. One reason was that he felt he had been making statements with similar careful qualifications during his entire public career, and the people of Texas had always understood them, particularly in light of his consistent record. "The people of Texas would understand this one," he said. "Of course people knew where he stood on Taft-Hartley and on organized labor," he said. "Who could possibly believe he would vote to repeal that act?" But he did not repeat his statement before the first primary. It appeared in the press, in just a few newspapers, really, only once. But behind Stevenson's refusal to repudiate the AFL endorsement lay also Lyndon Johnson's genius at reading men. Johnson had read Coke Stevenson now, and he knew his weakness, his fierce pride, particularly a pride in his reputation for honesty and truthfulness. All his public life, from the time he had been a young county attorney and opponents had attacked his handling of the rustling case involving the son of the prominent Kimball County family, he had refused to utter a single word of reply to personal attacks. So Johnson, to keep him from replying, made the attacks personal. Not only did Johnson himself and his supporters, in radio broadcast after broadcast, continue their attack on the old man, ridiculing his lack of courage, impugning his honesty, not only did they demand that Stevenson tell the truth about his secret deal on the Taft-Hartley bill, but the demands were deliberately couched in language that Murphy says anyone who knew Governor Stevenson knew he would never reply to. For example, Johnson backer Ed Leach, editor of the Longview Morning Journal, wrote to Stevenson demanding that he speak out. "I would like to ask you to break a precedent by stating your position on anything, but particularly on the Taft-Hartley law." Johnson had read his man. Stevenson responded just as Johnson had known he would respond. Since the personal attacks concerned his refusal to say whether he was for Taft-Hartley, it became a matter of pride for him not to say whether he was for it. He said he would not be drawn into a name-calling exchange. Voters knew his views on organized labor, he said. He hadn't changed, and they could be sure he never would. And because his support of Taft-Hartley had not been widely publicized, Stevenson's stance allowed Johnson to claim that Stevenson had never disclosed his views. Indeed, newspapers would state repeatedly that the former governor had made no statement about Taft-Hartley. Stevenson's response was based not only on philosophy, but on the buttressing of that philosophy by a lifetime's experience. Time and time again during his long career, candidates had attacked him personally, and he had been advised to reply. And time and time again he had refused, always giving the same reason. His record would speak for him. The voters knew where he stood. He hadn't changed. The voters would therefore know the charges were false. And, naive and unrealistic though this reasoning had seemed, time and again it had been proven correct. Attack after attack had shattered against his image, in part because his image was so close to the truth that there were no cracks in which the charges could lodge. The charges had indeed been false, and the voters had indeed not believed them. But Stevenson didn't understand that, as Boyette puts it, Lyndon Johnson wasn't like other candidates. He didn't understand that Lyndon Johnson's campaign wasn't like other campaigns, that it was something new in Texas politics. Never before had attacks against Stevenson been repeated day after day, week after week, not only on the radio, that powerful medium, now for the first time in Texas being exploited to its fullest, but in weekly newspapers, daily newspapers, in campaign mailings, so that voters heard and saw the charges against him, it seemed, every time they turned on the radio, read a newspaper, opened their mail. Never before had there been a campaign in which the same phrases were drummed into voters' consciousness so constantly all through June and July. Secret deal? Perhaps Coke Stevenson felt he wouldn't dignify the charge by denying it. But dignity was a luxury in a fight with Lyndon Johnson, a luxury too expensive to afford. Perhaps Stevenson had too much pride to deny the charge. Pride was a luxury that an opponent of Lyndon Johnson could not afford. Once Johnson found an issue, true or untrue, that touched, he hammered it until people started to believe it. He had one that touched now. He had found the jugular, and he wasn't letting go. The charges Johnson was making against Coke Stevenson were false, manufactured out of whole cloth, in fact. They were as false as any charges that had been made against Stevenson in the past. But this time, people were beginning to wonder whether they might not be true. Even the former governor's strongest supporters were beginning to wonder, as was shown in a column which expressed the views of the Dallas conservatives. Mr. Leach's letter to Mr. Stevenson was a trifle discourteous, it is true, Lynn Landrum wrote in the Dallas News, but it seems reasonable to expect that Mr. Stevenson, in his own way, will inform the public on this matter, which now seems to have become a critical issue in the race. The people of Texas are substantially in favor of the Taft-Hartley Act. They will want to know Mr. Stevenson's views. Within a startlingly short time after Johnson had begun campaigning by helicopter, his private polls had shown him cutting into Stevenson's lead, and every day that gap had narrowed. On June 20th, a new Belden poll had been published. Stevenson was no longer leading him by 64% to 28, but only by 47 to 37, with Petty having 12%. Minor candidates had a total of 4%. The erosion in Stevenson's popularity, Johnson's more experienced advisers had realized, was not as great as it seemed at first glance, since Petty had had only an insignificant 3% in the May poll, and his backers, conservatives, would return to Stevenson once Petty was out of the race. But now Johnson's polls showed that since the AFL endorsement, the gap had closed still further, after weeks in which it had seemed that nothing could erode Stevenson's popularity. There was an erosion at last. With his helicopter and his issue, Johnson's mood veered from depression to elation. His euphoria was intense. Often, when his aides came at 5 a.m. to wake him, they found him already awake, and if he wasn't, he woke the moment Woody gently touched his shoulder. And Woodward recalls, "He started at full speed. The minute we woke him up, he hit the ground running, giving orders and gulping coffee while he shaved. As he headed out the door of his room for his daily 6:45 a.m. broadcast, one staffer would call, 'He's moving out,' to alert the others downstairs, for they would have to scramble to keep up. As he passed them, his strides were long and his arms were swinging. He was, in the words of the adoring Woody, a general moving out in front of his troops." After the broadcast, as stilted and stentorian as ever, the engineers in the studios of the little local stations frantically turning dials in an attempt to modulate his voice, he headed for the chopper. Charging from morning to night across the bare brown plains of West Texas, the Johnson City windmill was landing in 8 or 9 towns each day now. Johnson was speaking in towns that few candidates for statewide office had ever visited. The helicopter was enabling him to do, on a statewide scale, what he had done in the 10th Congressional District during his first campaign, to go to the people at the forks of the creek. Many of them, perhaps most of them, had never seen a candidate for the United States Senate before. But they saw Lyndon Johnson, saw him, and heard him talk. He talked, for example, about his combat experiences, or what he said were his combat experiences. His service in the war was, of course, one of the major themes of his campaign. One of Woody's assignments was to transfer the Silver Star bar to the lapel of whatever suit jacket Johnson was wearing that day. When possible, he wanted to be introduced by a veteran, preferably one whose service and sacrifice had been dramatized by the loss of a limb. In Spur, for example, Johnson would ordinarily have been introduced by his most powerful and prominent supporter, a physician named Brannan, but it was arranged that Brannan would introduce Jake Vernell, a veteran who had lost a leg in the war, and that Vernell would be the man who introduced the congressman. So successful was the Johnson campaign in locating pro-Johnson amputees for this task that the percentage of men introducing Lyndon Johnson who still possessed all their limbs was surprisingly small. And the introductions stressed the war service. Congressman Johnson was fighting in the Pacific until he was recalled to his congressional duties. Particularly effective was a broadcast over a statewide radio hookup by veterans who told the story of their own war exploits and tied them into Johnson's, or what they thought to be Johnson's. Typical of the newspaper coverage of the broadcast was the lead in the Austin American Statesman. 7 World War II heroes, young men new to politics, told why they are supporting Congressman Lyndon Johnson, who was awarded a Silver Star by General MacArthur for gallantry in combat action. But no one else could talk about Johnson's exploits the way Johnson could talk about them. "I shared your boys' experiences," he would say in those small towns in which war heroes were revered and in which so many families had lost a son. "I said that if war was declared, I'd go to war beside them, and I did." He would point to the pin in his lapel or wave the lapel back and forth at the audience, or, when carried away by enthusiasm, would yank off his jacket and hold it over his head with the lapel stretched out. "That's the Silver Star. General MacArthur gave it to me." He had made sacrifices just as their boys had, he said. He had intended to run in the Senate election in 1942, he said, but when that election came around, I was in the jungles of New Guinea. And he said, "I knew what it is to see boys die because I had a friend die. He was the boy I roomed with," Lyndon Johnson said. "He was a country boy, too. He was a pilot, and he flew a B-17, and he was a colonel. His name was Francis Stevens, but we all called him Steve." They had been on a mission together, Johnson said, and Stevens's plane had been shot down, and he had perished in the crash. And to him, Lyndon Johnson had fallen the task of collecting Steve's personal effects and mailing them to his mother. "I sat in that little room we had shared together, and I got all the letters his mama had written him, and I tied them up to send back to her. And I packed up his clothes. I remember I rolled up his socks. They smelled bad, but they were his, so I sent them to his mama, too." and though his wartime experiences were somewhat exaggerated, the telling was tremendously effective, particularly when he tied the experiences in with his pleas for preparedness. Peace, preparedness, and progress might be the words he used during his stilted radio broadcasts, but here, face to face with the people whose votes he needed, he used different words. "It cost us a lot of lives because we weren't prepared when the Japs attacked," he said. "I'd rather save lives than money," he said. "It's either your boys' lives or tax rebates for millionaires." These words touched a deep chord in his listeners. One of the hands he shook after his talk at Graham was that of a farm wife. "My boy died on Iwo Jima," she said. "I know what you mean." At Sweetwater, an old man approached Johnson and tried to say something, but had to stop when he began to cry. And the press coverage of his war record was all that could be desired. Talking about Lady Bird's concern for his safety in a helicopter, the Port Arthur News reported that Johnson said that his wife didn't show particular concern when he was flying in B-29s, helping bomb one Japanese island after another into submission 3 years ago. His flights over jungle wastes and limitless expanses of the ocean were all right by her, for she realized the job had to be done, the congressman says. But when she heard that some of my old wartime buddies were volunteering to fly me all over Texas to meet the voters in a helicopter, she threw up her hands. And he talked about his opponent. He had emerged from the hospital determined to try to destroy Coke Stevenson's reputation, and he had been concentrating on doing so in his formal speeches, with attacks that had been growing steadily more personal. He kept calling his 60-year-old opponent an old man. Stevenson had retired to his ranch, Johnson said, and the only reason he was running for the Senate was that he had discovered that senators were paid $15,000 a year. Stevenson wasn't planning to do any work for that money, just collect it as if it were a pension, Johnson said. "I am not for the $15,000 pension you'll be giving this old man if you elect him." And then, somewhere near the end of June, Lyndon Johnson changed his mode of attack, in a stroke of pure political genius. Washington had learned of Lyndon Johnson's gift for mimicry, of the accuracy with which he could capture a man's traits and imitate and exaggerate them in a devastating form of mockery. Now he began to use that gift in the small towns of Texas, on the man who had for so many years been a hero in those towns. The people's very familiarity with the former governor, and with his well-known mannerisms and phrases, made him a good target. Johnson's mimicry took the form of an interview in which he played two parts, a reporter and Stevenson. First playing the reporter, he asked a question. "What are your views on federal aid to education, perhaps?" Then, taking a step away, he turned as if facing the reporter and played Stevenson. Out and up came Lyndon Johnson's jaw in an imitation of Coke's. His hands went to his hips, in the former governor's habitual stance when answering questions. And he rocked back and forth on his heels, as Stevenson did while thinking, and paused for a while before answering. "I believe in constitutional government," he finally said. "Are you for or against the 70 Group Air Force?" the reporter would ask, jaw, hands, rocking, in flawless imitation, the long pause which had given Coffee, Cool, and Coke his nickname. Finally, "I believe in constitutional government." "It was perfect," a reporter said. "It was Coke to the life." The only element missing was Coke's pipe. And then suddenly Johnson had an inspiration. While performing his imitation one day, he noticed a farmer right in front of him smoking a large corncob pipe. Reaching out, Johnson grabbed it, stuck it in his own mouth, and added it to the act. Now, after his reporter asked Stevenson, "How do you stand on the 70 Group Air Force?" his governor hurriedly stuck the pipe in his mouth as if panicked by the question, and drew deeply on it, puckering up his eyes in mock concentration, until he finally removed it, studied it for another long moment, and then said, "I believe in constitutional government." At every stop thereafter, Johnson would borrow a pipe from some man in the crowd. "With one eye on the labor bosses in Fort Worth and the other eye on the millionaires in Houston, he sits and smokes," Johnson would say. He would place the pipe in his mouth, stick out his jaw, put his hands on his hips, and rock back on his heels until he had the crowd giggling. Then he would mutter through the pipe stem, "I'm for states' rights." "And what do you think about federal aid for veterans?" Long pause. "Well, I don't want to move the county courthouse to Washington." Then, having made the crowd receptive, he could launch into a stronger attack. These savage personal onslaughts were directed against perhaps the most respected public official in the history of Texas. They were a great gamble, part of the great gamble that Johnson was taking in the whole campaign. From Jacksonville, Horace Busby reported, "The congressman has gone berserk. He is using a satire on Stevenson." But, Busby added, "the satire seems to be going over with the crowds fine." People who had known him for years said they had never seen Lyndon Johnson so high. He had always deeply needed crowds and the feeling from them of acceptance and warmth and respect. Now, thanks to the helicopter and to his own gifts, he was getting that feeling. "When he got in a crowd of people, that was when he was at his happiest," Woodward recalls, "and these were very special crowds for him." "He really thrived on the helicopter and on the crowds that would come out," Margaret Mayer recalls. "He was energized. He was really charged up." He was, in fact, carried away, at times all but out of control. A key to his handshaking method of taking their hand first was to reach for the people coming toward him to shake his hand and, in effect, pull them past him. Shaking hands on the flatbed truck after the speech, he would sometimes be so excited that he would not only forget the pain in his cracked hands, but would pull on voters' arms so enthusiastically that the voters needed all their alertness and physical strength to avoid being yanked off balance as Johnson pulled them past. "He was just throwing little old ladies past him," Busby recalls. "Woody and I stationed ourselves below the platform in case any of them needed to be caught." "When he was shaking hands, that was when he got most charged up," Margaret Mayer recalls. "It was just like he was plugged into electricity." During the handshaking, of course, KTBC announcer Joe Phipps was delivering over the helicopter microphone a nonstop spiel about the congressman's accomplishments, and sometimes the congressman became absolutely carried away by enthusiasm as Phipps's voice boomed out, "Come meet Congressman Johnson. He got roads for the 10th District. He got lights for the 10th District. If you elect him, he'll get lights for you. He'll get roads for you." Sometimes, as Phipps's voice was filling the air, his subject, shaking hands on the truck, would shout to the announcer across the heads of the crowd, "Tell him about me, Joe. Tell him about me." Then the helicopter would take off, and Lyndon Johnson would be up in the air again, charging across the face of Texas, circling closer and closer to farmhouses to the accompaniment of pandemonium in the chicken coop and panic in the stable, landing beside railroad repair crews and little groups of farm workers so he could hug them and give them leaflets. Occasionally, the pilot would simply circle the workers as Johnson bellowed down and showered them with great handfuls of campaign literature, but only occasionally. He would rarely pass a group without going down, Busby recalls. I would say, hell, they're not going to vote. He drew himself up in one of his more noble poses and said, son, they're people. Seeing a train roaring along beneath him, he insisted on shooters dipping low above the flat prairie and then racing the train for miles, the S-51 gradually passing the long line of freight cars as the engineer tooted his whistle in excitement. Circling a town where he was to land, he would lean far out of the helicopter window, waving his gray Stetson at the people below while he shouted, "Come to the speaking! Come to the speaking!" Above larger cities, he went wild. Coming into Port Arthur, where the Port Arthur News was to proclaim the next day under the headline, "It Lands on Roofs and in Pastures," that candidate Lyndon B. Johnson's flying windmill is probably the greatest political innovation since the invention of the ballot, he circled the downtown shopping area again and again at a height of 300 feet, leaning out over the helicopter window and yelling down through a megaphone. The helicopter's public address system was broken that day. "Hello, Port Arthur! Hello, Port Arthur! You look wonderful down there! Hello, Port Arthur!" while showering the city with his leaflets. Between cities, he urged shooters to fly faster. And in his enthusiasm, Lyndon Johnson leaned out of the helicopter and, in the words of one reporter, whipped his Stetson on the plane's flanks as though it were a bronco that he was urging on to greater speed. Following him was quite an experience, too. Advance man Sam Plyler would leave each stop as soon as the helicopter touched down, because he had to be at the next stop before it arrived to make sure the landing area had been cleared, and he needed all the head start he could get. Sam drove wide open as fast as the car would go, Tudors recalls. Even so, if the town was some distance away, Plyler couldn't be sure he would make it in time, and as he sped along, he would keep darting backward glances into the sky to see if the black dot had come into view behind him. The other cars would wait until the helicopter lifted off, and then they would race out after it. There was quite a line of them. One car carried mechanic Natchlin and the radio engineer, and a two-way radio linked with Tudor's so that Natchlin could be summoned without delay in case engine trouble forced the helicopter down. Another carried a secretary and a speechwriter, generally Paul Bolton, and his typewriter. Another carried Busby and his typewriter. Then there was a car for Woody and his suitcases filled with the candidates' shirts, ties, pills, lozenges, and hand creams. Sometimes there was a car for the band. Their absences for the campaign had cost the band's four members their radio station job, but Johnson told them not to worry. Someday you'll sing on the steps of the White House. And then there were the reporters' cars, more and more of them as the flying windmill became bigger and bigger news. Quite a caravan careened across Texas that summer. Advance men, secretaries, speechwriters, aides, reporters, band members, sound truck operators, all of them, in Frank Altorf's phrase, driving like hell along highways or narrow country roads, going just as fast as they could, while scanning the skies and hoping to make the next town before the windmill landed. State troopers stopped them. Once waved over by a trooper, Plyler pleaded that he had to get to the schoolyard in the town up ahead because the helicopter was going to land there, and he had to make sure no children got hurt. The trooper said, "Okay, I'll follow you. If that helicopter doesn't come in there, you're going to jail." And Plyler roared off again, the trooper flooring his gas pedal to keep up. Tires blew out. Altorf remembers a blowout while he was doing 80 on the narrow, bumpy road, and how he was almost unable to get the car under control. Engines blew out. When a car was disabled, the driver simply abandoned it, like a dead horse, by the side of the road and flagged down another. The important thing was not to miss the windmill's next landing. Until the end of their lives, these men and women would tell stories about the summer they followed Lyndon Johnson and his flying windmill around Texas. As Oliver Knight of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram would write about one trip, "That mad dash from Navasota to Conroe, in which I dodged stumps at 70 miles per hour just to keep up with that contraption, will ever be green in my memory." At the landing site, there would be the brief respite while Johnson gave his speech and shook hands. And then he would clamber back into the helicopter, and the advance men would push back the crowd to clear enough room for the takeoff, and the mechanics, secretaries, speechwriters, advance men, aides, and reporters would run back to their cars and screech off again in their long, frenzied dash back and forth across the state of Texas. Dorothy Nichols was to be asked what she remembered about the 1948 campaign. 3 hours of sleep, she would reply. 3 hours of sleep, or less. And she remembered wet hair. Like the rest of the staff, Mrs. Nichols would recall she had to be awake every morning at 5, and after the early morning broadcast would spend the entire day racing frantically from town to town, trying to keep up with the helicopter, at each town being given a long list of telephone calls to make or memos or speeches to type at the noon or evening stops. We tried to make every speech, but at any rate we had to get to the noon rest stop ahead of him because we had his luggage. We had to get the hotel all in order for him to come in, unpack his suitcase, because he would get into his pajamas and get in bed and have a rest. So that was my job. I was valet, in other words. Then at night there would always be a meeting after dinner, a local meeting. So it was late hours. I had to tuck him in bed and give him his pills and try to remember whether he had taken them or not, which sometimes was hard. I'd get to bed about 3:30 every morning and roll up my hair. Those were the days when we put pin curls in our hair, wet, and I would wake up at 5 o'clock every morning and comb it out, and it was still wet, but I did it again the next night. I took a book to read, a whodunit, and read the same sentence on page 13 every night. The original plan had been for Mrs. Nichols to stay with the candidate as secretary for the whole campaign, but that plan survived only until the campaign's first weekend, when she arrived back in Austin with the candidate and reported in at the Hancock House. "They took one look at me at headquarters and realized that I couldn't take it all the time," she recalls. "It was decided that for the rest of the campaign, she, Mary Rather, and Dorothy Plyler would alternate on the road, 1 week on and 2 weeks back at headquarters, where the pace was less inhuman. Even with this schedule, however, by the end of the campaign, the three women would be exhausted. And, as Mrs. Nichols was to point out, we were only doing it one out of every 3 weeks. He was doing it all the time." Even when he was supposed to be resting, they came to realize he wasn't. At the noon rest stop, Lyndon Johnson would indeed get into bed, but when someone came to waken him after an hour or so, he would almost invariably be awake, awake and ready with a long list of things to be done, things he had thought of during the hour. "He had been on the phone the whole time," Mrs. Nichols would say, or, "He had somebody, local people or somebody on the staff, in their planning." The afternoons would be long, hour after hour of flying across country, hovering over towns and speaking from the air, landing at farmhouses or in cotton fields, and 8 or 9 or 10 times a day delivering a speech in a town, then shaking the hands of every member of the crowd. And evening brought no respite. Orphan Johnson would arrive at the town in which he was to spend the night just in time to race to his hotel, strip off his wringing wet clothes, take a quick shower, dress and head out for the evening's event, a rally or a Rotary Club or Chamber of Commerce banquet, at which, after a reception, he would give a formal speech. And after the dinner and the handshaking would come an informal reception for prominent local supporters and financial contributors, identified as FCs, for Fat Cats, in briefing memos for the day, either in Johnson's hotel suite or at the home of one of the fattest of the cats, receptions that were quite important because they gave Johnson an opportunity to meet new supporters or to cement relations with those he knew only slightly, and to allay the fears of so many of them that he might secretly be a liberal after all. In his initial instructions to his schedulers, Johnson had been very firm about the necessity for ending his evenings early. "You don't make any converts after 10 o'clock," he had said. Before 10, therefore, Woody and other aides would begin trying to move visitors out of the room. But after the visitors had left, there would be a long list on yellow legal notepads of people who had been trying to reach him that day, and the calls were returned. Every one. "He did not spare himself," Woodward recalls. In Washington, the importance of callers was weighed, and many calls were not returned. Now, however, every name represented someone he needed. And before he went to bed, every name on the list would have a line through it and a brief notation for a follow-up letter to be sent in his name by headquarters. Sometimes a name on the list would represent a potential gain of only a single vote. The call was made. Shaking Johnson's hand after a speech in Candelia, an elderly man mentioned a favorite nephew, James H. Knapp, who was an attorney in Arlington, a town near Dallas. In Arlington, Johnson telephoned Knapp to give him his uncle's regards and ask for his support. Knapp was not home when Johnson telephoned, but Johnson wrote him a letter, and in it said, "I am taking the liberty of dropping a note to your uncle." And as soon as he hung up the telephone, it seemed it would ring, and it might be Alvin Wirtz or Ed Clark or Claude Wilde or John Connolly, with some matter that had to be discussed and thought through, and the thinking had to be clear, no matter how tired he was, for calls from these men were important. And the candidate would be telephoning headquarters himself, making call after call every time he thought of some item, no matter how minor, that might help his campaign. Wilde urged him to stop. "Worry yourself about as few of the details of the campaign as you possibly can," the veteran campaign strategist said in a hand-delivered memo. "You can't run an organization with the perfection you might like to see it with volunteer and scattered help." Wilde had heard how exhausted Johnson was, and he said the important thing was to keep yourself physically in shape to continue your fine campaign. The others knew better than to try to stop their chief from worrying. 11 o'clock would pass, and then midnight, and then, often, 1 o'clock and 2, and Lyndon Johnson, gaunt and haggard under his tan, would still be lying in his underwear on the bed in a sweltering small-town hotel room, cigarette in one hand, telephone in the other, trying to do everything. Woody came to wake him at 5, and often Lyndon Johnson was already awake, with more items on a list, more things his restless mind had thought up during the few hours in which he had been supposed to be sleeping. And when he left the hotel for that early morning broadcast, which was to be followed by the breakfast speech, and then by the grueling day in the helicopter, he left with those long strides and swinging arms. "He groused about no breaks," Woodward would recall years later, "but if there came a day when every minute wasn't filled, then he was furious." Ed Clark, who had seen so many campaigners, said of Lyndon Johnson's 1937 campaign for Congress, "I never saw anyone campaign as hard as that. I never thought it was possible for anyone to work that hard." If that campaign had been Johnson's main chance, this campaign, the 1948 campaign, might be his last chance. Was 1937 the hardest Lyndon Johnson ever worked? Ed Clark would be asked. "Oh, no," Clark said. "In 1948, he worked harder." There was a single pause in this headlong rush. One brief time out for a visit unconnected with politics. On June 2nd, his helicopter grounded in Waco by high winds, Lyndon Johnson was touring 9 north-central Texas towns by car. And one of the towns was Marlin. His official schedule in Marlin called only for a speech, a handshaking tour, and quick courtesy calls on 2 or 3 local officials. Without the helicopter, he was running very late by the time he reached Marlin, and as he fell further behind schedule there, his aides warned him that unless he hurried, he might have to cancel the last two or three towns he was supposed to visit. But before he left, as his advance men were urging him into his car for the drive to the next town, he suddenly said, "No, there's someone I have to see here." Cutting off his aide's protests, he said curtly, "This is something that has to be done." He had his local campaign manager drive him to the home of Alice Glass's mother, and while his staff fretted outside, looking at their wristwatches, he had a long, leisurely visit whose significance they could not understand. Those who knew him realized the toll being exacted by his frantic pace. Walter Jenkins had seen his chief drive himself to the verge of exhaustion before, but now Jenkins saw he was more tired than he had ever been. Others saw frenzy, a frenzy that came close to hysteria. One reporter, interviewing him, watched Johnson sit in a chair for a few minutes, jump up, sit in another chair, jump up again, pace around the room, lie on the bed, jump up and sit in a chair again, and wrote, "He's just too nervous to remain still." And as he moved restlessly from chair to chair, he puffed cigarettes, lighting one from the end of another. He rubbed big gobs of purple salve into his hands. He tilted back his head and sprayed his throat with a vaporizer and his nose with an inhaler. He gulped pills from a variety of bottles on the dresser. He stuck lozenges in his mouth and in his nervousness chewed instead of sucked them so that he had to keep putting new ones in his mouth. Intensifying this nervousness was the cocoon of optimism in which he was wrapped. In town after town, the report from his local campaign manager was glowing. He was pulling up on Old Coke. He was ahead of Old Coke. They'd never thought anyone could give Old Coke a run for his money, but by God, Lyndon, you're doing it. This, of course, is standard in any campaign, for local leaders are prone to be overimpressed by the aura of excitement which surrounds the candidate on his visit to their area, and are anxious, moreover, to let the candidate know how well they are doing on his behalf. But it was intensified in Johnson's case by the well-known violence of his reaction to any news that was not good. No one wanted to be the one to give him such news, and as a result he did not receive much of it. And while ordinarily his keen political instincts would have helped him to give such optimism its appropriate weight, he was even further charged up now by the peculiar nature of this campaign, both his and Coke's. Crowd size had always augured political success in Texas. Thanks to his helicopter, he was in many areas drawing unprecedented crowds, and their response was good. And it was not merely the testimony of his own managers and of his own eyes that contributed to Johnson's euphoria, but what he read, the results of that last poll which showed such substantial gains. The articles about his opponent's candidacy. Even Petty was blanketing the state with radio speeches and developing a surprisingly strong campaign organization in Houston and some East Texas counties. And what was Coke Stevenson doing? Still interrupting his campaign to attend to the shearing or the branding on his ranch, still driving from town to town, shaking hands, chatting with people, seldom giving a speech, and when he did speak, saying the same old things. As for radio talks, when Stevenson took to the air on July 16th, it was only the third speech he had given in 3 months. In it he said he would do as I have done in the past, uphold constitutional government, and be a good steward of public funds. He said he favored aiding the western nations of Europe, keeping America strong, opposing extensions of federal control. "The people of Texas know me," he concluded. "I don't have the money to hire an army of paid workers all over the state or to write a letter to every holder of a poll tax, but I have something more valuable. I have friends and supporters in every county in Texas who know the principles I stand for and who like those principles." Reporters said there was no news in the speech, that it was essentially the same talk he had been giving several times each day in the small towns to which he traveled. They said there was no news in his campaign. Indeed, during the previous few weeks, reporters had all but stopped covering Coke. For what, after all, was there to report? For days at a time, the ex-governor all but vanished from view in the media. The scant coverage he received was not infrequently tinged with ridicule. A typical article described one of Coke's campaign days as 5 towns and 95 handshakes. Johnson was seeing thousands of people each day, shaking hundreds of hands, was on the radio morning and night, and often noon. By all the standard indices of campaigning, he was doing well, and Coke was doing very badly. Also playing a role in Johnson's feelings, it may be, was the depth of his need to believe what he was hearing and reading, to feel that he would succeed in his last chance. One of the typical violent alterations in Lyndon Johnson's moods had occurred. He was as euphoric in late June as he had been depressed early in the month. The prospect of victory always made his conduct as overbearing as the prospect of defeat made it humble to the point of obsequiousness. And now he was confident of victory. By the end of June, he was so euphoric as to be all but hysterical, a candidate at the point of irrationality. He found it impossible to control himself, it seemed, even before the public he was trying to court. The slightest thing that went wrong triggered explosions of a kind with which his aides had long been familiar, but which could only antagonize voters. Once he arrived at a meeting where he was not supposed to give a speech and learned that the organization expected a short talk. Wheeling on his hapless advancemen, he screamed as the club members looked on, "I thought it was just going to be coffee, donuts, and bullshit." On another occasion, advance man Cliff Carter had arranged to have the principal of Robstown High School and a delegation of teachers and students on the steps to greet him. "Please," Johnson told Carter, "he wanted to shake the hands of every student in the school, in fact, every student in the whole city. That would take hours." "We don't have time, sir," Carter said, and produced the list of all the stops he was already scheduled to make. Johnson didn't even look at the paper. Instead, he looked at Carter. As the principal observed the intensity of Johnson's glare, the hand he had extended to welcome the candidate slowly dropped to his side. The smiles faded from the faces of the delegation. There was a long silence. Then Johnson said, in the low, threatening tone that his aides feared more than any other, "Are we going to join the Can't Do It Club right here on the steps of Robstown High School?" Hotel lobbies became stages for violent scenes. There might be a brief delay in registration, or a bellboy might be slow in arriving to take the candidate's bags. Johnson would shriek at the desk clerk or bellboy in public as he screamed at Woody or Mary Rather in private, while other patrons stared in astonishment. Hotel suites became stages, too. He never got a meal that he didn't find fault with, Horace Busby recalls. "I just couldn't stand it, the way he'd beat up on the waiter or waitress. He would send back the food. Tell the cook I never saw so much fat on a piece of meat." He would ring the bell and tell the desk clerk, "This may be the worst hotel I've ever stayed in." The suites became stages even when the audience was the audience he most needed to impress favorably, local political leaders and their wives. "I'm talking about explosions, tirades," Horace Busby explains, "especially explosions against the women who worked for him. Everyone in this outfit is against me," that kind of thing. Local politicians would come into his hotel suite with their eyes all aglow over the opportunity to meet him, all enthusiastic, and you could just see the light turn off. His behavior was hurting him with local politicians, Busby says, and with their wives, whom they had often brought along to meet the great man, and who were even more shocked than their husbands at his abusiveness, particularly toward his female secretaries. If Johnson realized the effect his conduct was having, however, he seemed unable or unwilling to change it. And, Busby says dryly, his nudity was inappropriate. Nudity? Rooms in many small-town hotels had only hand basins with communal toilets at the end of the hall. These bathrooms were small and hot, and it was cooler if the door was left open, so often Johnson left it open. Not a few voters, therefore, saw the candidate for the United States Senate sitting on the toilet, and described that sight to relatives and friends. Once in Corsicana, Busby says, several key local supporters arrived at his suite with their wives for a private social hour following a speech. He received them nicely, but then it was time for them to leave, and they didn't. He kept looking over at me to get them out of there. But the supporters were oblivious to Buzz's hints. They were lost in rapture. So, Busby says, right in front of them he just starts undressing. When he had taken off his tie and shirt, and they still hadn't left, he started taking off his pants. The ladies started looking at the ceiling. Someone said, maybe it was time to let Mr. Johnson get some rest. He couldn't control himself even with, or in front of, the press. This book is continued on Cassette 9, Side 1.